Welcome and thank you for holding. At this time, your lines are in a listen-only mode. A public comment period is scheduled to take place after the opening remarks. If you are interested in commenting on today's topic, you may press star 1 on your phone at any time to be placed into the queue. There is a limited time set aside for public comment, so please keep your comment to less than 1 minute. Stating your name and affiliation when prompted is optional, however, please provide at least an identifying alias. This will assist in administering this session. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like to turn the call over to Odette Madriago. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. I am Odette Madriago, Acting Chief Deputy Director of the Department of Toxic Substances Control. Good morning, everyone. Glad you could join us. This is our second and final subcommittee number one call discussing the topic of chemical identification and prioritization. Again, this is our final call before we bring this issue before the full GRASP meeting on May 5th and 6th. Very shortly, your chair, Tim Geiser, will review with you the focus of today's phone call, which will be focused on providing the department as well as the entire GRASP each member's specific and concrete suggestions on this topic, and Ken will go into a little bit more detail. So at this point, without further ado, let's go on to the next section. I'm going to turn this back over to Kathy Barwick.
Hello. Thank you, Odette. I'm Kathy Barwick, staff to DTSC as well as the panel. I'm going to do a brief roll call of panel members, and then we'll go around the room here at DTSC. And I want to take this opportunity to remind the subcommittee members that when you speak in the meeting, please state your name before you start talking so people know who you are. And we want to make sure that everybody can hear you, so please stay right on the phone. Okay, here's the roll call. Ken Geiser?
Here.
Julia Quint?
Here.
George Dastan?
Here.
Julie Zimmerman? Lauren Hines? Art Fong?
Here.
Tim Malloy?
Here.
And I was informed from Meg Schwartzman and Rich Liroff cannot attend today. So we may be joined by a couple of other panel members as we go along. And around the room, we'll start with Corey.
Corey, yes. Gabby Gomez.
Alan Hirsch of the State Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment.
Jeff Long.
Cortez Camini.
Thank you. And I wanted to remind everybody that there's a recording of this meeting that will be posted. And by the way, the ones that we have had already will be posted. We're having a few technical difficulties. So those will be on our website after the meeting at some point. And now I'd like to turn this over to your chair, Ken Geiser.
Yes, thank you, Odette. And thank you, members of the subcommittee, for taking the time for our second round at this topic of chemical identification and prioritization. I'll just make a few comments here just to get us sort of back in the groove that we were successfully pursuing at our call last Monday. I think it's important to remember that we are, the intention here is that we provide advice and comment to the department, and we do so as individual panel members. We're not trying to reach consensus or agreement. We're trying to provide the best that we can in helping the department staff shape these recommendations for the actual regulations. It's also important to notice that this, take note that this is a public meeting, and we will, in a short moment, make some time for public comment itself, and that some other members of the Green Ribbon Science panel may be listening in as well. Our plan, of course, is to try to complete our work today and such that we can make a report at our May 4th meeting in Sacramento. So the results of today's conversation and last week's conversation will make up that report itself. A couple of additional comments since our last meeting. The department has sent out a few additional background papers, mostly provided by Tim Malloy. And Tim, thank you. Hopefully panel members have had a chance to see those background documents as well. I won't go through them directly. We've also had comment in writing made by the Green Chemistry Alliance, and I believe that Kathy sent those out as well over the last several days. Let me just check. Maybe I will stop there. I think that in terms of where we want to focus our discussion today, it's really going to be a good deal on the second question, the question which is, I believe, 1B. But I will take a few minutes before the opening of our actual discussion to do that and go into what I'm hoping we could get out of some of that itself. At the moment, I think that covers my introductory remarks. I'm looking forward to a good, thorough discussion of this area and hopeful engagement with the staff. And I think at this point I'd like to turn this back over to the operator to open this up for public comment.
At this time, if you would like to provide comments to the Green Ribbon Science Panel subcommittee members on today's topic, please press star 1 and ensure your line is not muted. You will be prompted to record your name. Stating your name and affiliation is optional. However, providing at least an identifying alias will assist us in managing the session. Again, pressing star 1 will enable you to join the queue and make a comment. If you wish to be removed from the queue, press star 2. One moment while we wait for our first comment.
And while we're waiting for that, we might want to just ask the panel members at the various locations if there are any members of the public visiting with them and that want to make comment.
Are there any comments from any of the sites or from anyone on the call who is in a listening mode?
Our first public comment is from Don Kepke. Ma'am, your line.
Can I ask how many people we have wishing to make public comments?
Right now there are 2 in queue.
All right. Thank you.
I apologize. The first one is from Don Kepke. Ma'am, your line is open.
Thank you. Good morning. Don Kepke on behalf of the Green Chemistry Alliance. Appreciate the opportunity to make comments again to the panel and to DTSC again this morning. So I think really what the Green Chemistry Alliance just wants to, you know, just remind everyone is that the whole genesis of this and the genesis of the enacting legislation was based on the interest in getting away from chemical by chemical and product by product bans in the legislature, taking it out of the policymakers' hands and putting it in the scientists' hands. And so we really want to be sure that we're looking at this practically from a science perspective, and that everything we do in the chemical identification prioritization process, as well as the other steps in the overall framework, be based on sound science and not a popularity contest of what the chemical or product du jour is. And so that's really critical for this program, from our perspective, to be viable and workable. We also would just reiterate some brief points from the comments I made on our last call, that we really believe that in order to get this program off the ground and running, we really should consider starting smaller, not looking at everything under the sun, and grow the program and chemicals reviewed over time as appropriate based on science and science advancements. Thus far, we've argued that looking at CMRs and PDTs as a starting point makes sense from our perspective. And we've offered some suggestions on what criteria and what other authoritative bodies would be relevant to look at for what chemicals in those particular categories perhaps would rise to consideration first. Also, we would note our interest and in making sure that the prioritization process focuses on evaluation of consumer exposure for products containing chemicals of concern that are targeted towards sensitive subpopulations rather than just on the properties of each chemical in the consumer product, since exposure and risk vary depending on the product and how and by whom that product is used. Also, just to expand on that, we're really insistent that exposure be an upfront consideration in the process, and that if there is no reasonable and foreseeable exposure pathway consistent with the provisions under Prop 65, that those products not rise to the top and essentially be put to the side pending any further science reasons for moving those otherwise. We really also, relative to the discussion on last call with regard to the list of lists approach, GCA is against a list of lists approach. We really believe that the chemicals that should be, you know, rising to the top as chemicals of concern be determined based on sound science criteria and clear process for prioritization, not just taking all lists out there and making one big list. I mean, from our perspective, if everything is, you know, on that list and everything is of concern, then nothing is of a potential greater concern. And so we really think we need to look at what the science says the most concerning chemicals are first and focus on that. And really, that goes back to...
Don, this is Odette. It's been about 3 minutes, so I'd like to ask that you try and wrap it up quickly.
Absolutely. Thank you. And lastly, just there was mention on the last call about OEHA perhaps getting involved in the prioritization and identification process. We believe that OEHA doesn't currently have the authority to do that, that the prioritization process, criteria development, and classification are the charge of DTSC, and so at this time, without any further authority for OEHA, we are opposed to that type of approach. And again, thank you for the additional time.
Thank you, Don. Yeah, I was sort of letting it go a little bit because there's, I assume there's only one more public comment.
Hi.
Operator?
Yes, the next comment is from Bo Gregg. Sir, your line is open.
Thank you, and good morning. This is Bill Greggs on behalf of the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Today's discussion is about chemical prioritization to identify chemicals of concern. To me, prioritization of chemicals in this context means setting up an order for the next steps in the AB 1879 process, kind of a relative ranking that would address the worst first. Prioritization shouldn't be a popularity contest. It should be scientific work. And such a process is ongoing in the Canadian Chemical Management Program, where the highest priority 500 chemicals were identified, where priority uses were identified, and they were assessed over the past 3 years. Canada is already taking risk management actions that have been initiated on these, and they're already moving into their sort of phase two of their chemical management program, which addresses their medium priority chemicals. I urge the panel on DTSC to make this about science, not about popularity, and suggest you look to Canada's thoughtful scientific approach, which is detailed in the pre-work. One additional comment that I'd like to make, Odette, is that I noticed in the pre-work there was something from the EU chemical authorities on REACH prioritization for the authorization list, and I'm not sure where you downloaded that paper for, but that seems to only focus on chemicals with PBT properties, and I just wanted to note that the CMRs, carcinogens, mutagens, and reproductive and developmental toxicants are also included as criteria for making the candidate list under REACH, and I just want to make sure that that's recognized. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Operator, do we have any other public comments?
I show no further comments at this time.
Let me just take a moment and make sure that there are no additional comments from the public. In that case, I believe we are complete that phase of our morning's work, and thank those members of the public who took the time to present their thoughts. With this point, we then turn to our discussion of the questions put forward by the department. I think in a brief debrief after our conversation last week with Odette and Kathy, we felt like our conversation had been helpful to the department, and several of the things that were brought forward were important in terms of providing at least a sense of direction that people had found. We took up initially the question of how many lists. There seemed to be several people that felt two lists were important, although that was not, there were others who thought one list might be. There was a general feeling that it would make a lot more sense to take up that question of two lists versus one list after we'd gotten further into the conversation. We spent quite a bit of time on question 1B, particularly the upper sections, items, sub-items 1, 2, 3, 4. The issue of authoritative lists took up some time. What do we mean by that? How do we determine what an authoritative list is, and what do we do about chemicals that don't show up on authoritative lists but may also be of concern? There was a general sense I heard, although I think that the list should be, whatever it is, should be an evolving kind of thing, that it that there should be a dynamic, et cetera, and there were several people who commented on different ways to think about having the list open to new information. There was thoughts on the quality of lists themselves and that the lists that are available range in quality. There was also thoughts on the range of potency that needs to be taken into account as well in thinking about the chemicals themselves. We moved somewhat toward the lower part of that question, down further into, particularly into thinking about how to assess things like exposure and adverse impact associated with the chemicals themselves, whether we might think about thresholds. But we actually didn't get very far, and I will note in a minute that I'm hoping that we can spend a good deal of time on that. We did take up question 1C. We looked at it briefly. Question 1C deals with the issue of whether there should be a sort of staging, some kind of so-called scope limit in the beginning, which allows the department to move more in a staged process into identifying chemicals and prioritizing them. There wasn't necessarily a large discussion on that. It did involve some interest in how many chemicals do we actually perceive, and one of the things that was interesting was that various members of the subcommittee seemed to have different ideas on what the starting number might be, although we didn't actually come up with a number, but just take note of the fact that we do have different perspectives on that. So my recommendation, and I'm going to open this to the committee very shortly because I want to make sure that others feel like this is the right place for our agenda, my suggestion would be that we focus our initial discussions on the lower sections of question 1B, particularly sections 5, 6, 7, 8, consider some of the points that have to do with the way the list is assembled in regards to thresholds, cumulative impact, and particularly in regards to prioritization, offering the department more advice on how we might think about helping, how might a good prioritization system work, and to whatever extent we can, what to do about chemicals that are known as bad actors, whatever we may mean by that. Does this sound okay, that we might focus a good deal of attention here on this section, or are there other areas that the subcommittee would like to focus in on this morning? No, I don't hear that. All right. Odette, do you want to say anything about these latter sections here, or do you want us just to take things up as they are on the way the questions have been formed and move forward?
I support really focusing in on those questions. I think they are the hardest questions that are posed, but they're the ones that we feel we can most benefit from the expertise and the thoughts of subcommittee members. And again, you know, the more specific and concrete each of you can be in your suggestions will be helpful, and I'm hoping that we will have time towards the end for each of you who are on the call to be able to summarize, but with some specifics, your own individual suggestions for the department and for the GRASS as a whole when they meet in May. That's it for me for now.
Great, great, very good. Well, seeing as I did bring this up, obviously our public comments have brought this question up as well, maybe we take a few minutes just on this exposure question and then move into the latter parts. Do we have anything in particular we would like, any member of the subcommittee would like to say about how to handle the exposure issue?
Ken, this is Art. May I make a comment, please?
Yes, please.
On the exposure question,
Art, could people still? I'll call on people. Try to state your name in the beginning. This Art Fong.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, thank you very much for the reminder. This is Art Fong of the Green Ribbon Science Panel. On the question of exposure, one of the public comments from the Green Chemistry Alliance was that exposure has to be an upfront component of chemical identification and prioritization. I was thinking how that might be done, because to me the exposure question really, it's the bridge that ties Subcommittee 1 to Subcommittee 2, because when you're talking about exposure, you know, you have to have very scenario-specific information versus general things like what you would information that you might have gathered from biomonitoring data that give you, you know, general information about the potential level of potential exposure that the public might be exposed to. But in our case, I think because we're concentrating on consumer products, it seems to me that this is a situation where, in fact, you know, this subcommittee, the chemical identification and prioritization bleeds in with the products prioritization, because, you know, when I'm thinking of exposure, I'm thinking of exposure, for example, like exposure that scenario that's related to, let's say, household cleaning products. So that gives me something to work with. Is that what DTSC and the public is talking about, or are we talking about exposure in the general sense of data that, you know, that gives us a general sense of public exposure, for example, from biomonitoring data or from data that's, you know, been generated looking at indoor air quality or dust, because that really makes a difference in terms of how that factors into the chemical identification aspects of what we're trying to do. Ken, thank you very much.
This, Odette, I'll answer very briefly, primarily by tossing this back to the subcommittee. This is what we are looking for your advice on, and Art is right. There are different ways you can look at exposure. Certainly, you can look for evidence of exposure to a chemical, such as in biomonitoring or environmental monitoring, but then you can also evaluate the scenarios, as Art pointed out, under which exposures could occur, and that gets to be very product and use specific.
This is George.
Yes, George, please go ahead.
George Dastin. And probably for the rest of the call, I'll just say George because I'm the only George on the call. So
then Julia wants to talk next. Let me get her in the queue.
All right. Thank you.
Great. First of all, I just wanted to say, you know, Art might think of household cleaning products, but I thought of computers first. So, I think Art is exactly right that this is an area that's going to have to overlap of necessity with the product identification group. That said, I think that there are probably some areas that are obvious in terms of, you know, where we'd want to have exposure information in the prioritization process. And, you know, certainly when we're thinking about environmental effects, concentrations in water or air or whatever medium we're measuring, I think, are going to be relevant. So, you know, I keep thinking about an example from one of our face-to-face meetings that Kelly Moran brought up of increasing levels of copper in water from new next-generation brake pads and things like that. So, you know, to me, those would be obvious kinds of things. You know, certainly product ingredient lists, production volume information, all of that's available, and biomonitoring data for that matter. I'd also like to see, since I think we will have a finite number of chemicals on this list, something done to try and also bridge the gap between exposure and potency and therefore risk in this process. And it is possible to do that fairly directly for environmental measurements and with increasingly available reverse pharmacokinetic tools for biomonitoring data. I do agree with the thought that the list will be much more relevant and impactful on public and environmental health if it has an exposure component.
Thank you, George. Julia?
Yes. The way I think, depending on your orientation, you can think about this question very differently. For me, you know, it's physical state of the chemical. If it's a liquid, I think about vapor pressure, ability to be inhaled like solvents. So right away, solvents rise to the top for me because they're very emissive. If they're in a product, even at moderate concentrations, there's a potential for exposure. But again, it would depend on the vapor pressure of the solvent. So that's the liquid. For some of the chemicals of concern that are on lists, like the Prop 65 list, just to pick one, you know, it's really going to depend whether or not you're talking about a dust or a respirable fiber or something like that. I review a lot of products. Right now I'm reviewing products in nail polishes. And they are, you know, you'd be surprised. There are things that show up that are like fiberglass, but it's a liquid. So, you know, and I'm only worried about fiberglass if it's something that I can, that you can breathe in. So if it's wet, you're not going to breathe it in. So, you know, that's the sort of level in terms of looking at first the innate properties of the chemical, and then looking at, when you think about products, is that chemical in that product going to be raise a exposure potential? Is there going to be a potential for exposure? Regarding product ingredients, I really rely heavily on the concentration of the ingredients in the product. If there is a product that has 50% N-methylpyrrolidone in it, which there are many out there, graffiti removers, then that's really going to rise to the top for me. If there is a chemical that you can buy at the hardware store that's 100% chemical of concern, whatever that might be, like toluene, which is used to strip paint, that's going to rise to the top for me because the consumer can go in and if she is pregnant and have, you know, just a short exposure to that chemical and doing a very short task, that would hit at both a vulnerable population for us and a potential for high exposure that where timing is involved. So I think, although it's complicated, I think with looking at some of the chemicals of concern on the various lists, given what we just know about how these chemicals are formulated in most products, you can make some sort of generalizations, at least I feel I can most of the time. But I think putting that into a specific sort of criteria that's not so based on
expert opinions if we're trying to get away, or expert judgment, we're trying to get away from that. I think that's where the challenge comes in, of trying to make it more objective as opposed to, you know, going through some individual's head as to how they do the sort of prioritization. But I would look first to our vulnerable populations. You know, is it something that, like a toddler could ingest from hand to mouth because it's in a product that you put on a floor or something, and it's a chemical of concern, it's on, you know, possibly in the household on some floor or piece of furniture and, or something, and is it an ingestion, you know, does it pose a hazard for a toddler or somebody who, you know, might do hand to mouth? So anyway, you know, take the exposure groups and look at the chemical properties, and we don't have product information right now, but, you know, when you look at the product, it has to be something that if there is a potential that this can get into somebody's body by one of the various routes of exposure, inhalation, ingestion, dermal, that sort of thing. And I, before I stop, I just want to say one thing. One thing that's really overlooked with a lot of chemicals, because the information isn't out there, those chemicals that can be absorbed through intact skin as well as inhalation. And the chemical that I just talked about, N-methylpyrrolidone, which is in graffiti removers, is one of those chemicals. So you have a double hazard. You have inhalation and you have skin absorption. Not just skin contact, but skin absorption. So I think those would rise to the top for me as well.
Wayne,
thank you, Julia.
Tim, I'd like to get on the queue, please.
Yes. Anyone else want to be on this queue, by the way? Tim, go ahead.
Thank you. And I also wanted to thank the folks who made the public comments, and also my colleagues on the panel. Those were really thoughtful comments as well and thought-provoking. The trouble I have with answering the question about exposure is a little bit of a chicken and the egg problem, because to me, as a general matter, it appears that at some point in the prioritization process, you have to take into account exposure, partially because the statute requires you to think about it, but also because it just makes sense, both from a conceptual and a practical standpoint. But where I run into problem is you need to know a little bit about, so for example, what are the other things and traits and criteria that you would use to create, say, first this chemical of concern list if you went that route. So in my mind, if the chemical of concern list was fairly discrete, say 50 chemicals, so on and so forth, then to me it would seem that it would be manageable to then move right to the product prioritization, because that's where you're going to get, I think, kind of the most focused information on exposure, and it's just, to me it seems like it's a manageable enough group that you could do it at that stage. If instead what you've got is this chemical concern list that is very large, then it seems to me that in order for it to work practically, you'd have to at least engage in some level of a screening based on a variety of factors, and one of those, I think, probably ought to be exposure. But again, you're going to be in a situation where, just from a resource constraints and practicality constraints and legal constraints perhaps, you're not going to have very much information, I think, about actual consumer exposure. I mean, I think people generally know for many chemicals what types of products that they're in, but there's the issue that I think in many instances, as Julia pointed out, you're surprised sometimes by what's in a particular product. So you're not going to have that level of information early on in the process, I think, to make really very finely grained or even moderately grained judgments about exposure. So it appears to me that if you end up with a list that's not quite as manageable, such that you could put off exposure to when you do product prioritization, that there should be something of some level of a screening approach that would incorporate consumer exposure. Yeah, I guess one thing is I heard Julia say we want to get away from this expert judgment, but I'm not really sure. I don't know if that's really necessarily the case. I mean, depending on how you define objective, it's not clear to me that, you know, coming up with, you know, a sensibly objective ranking system with numbers and weights and all is really all that much more objective than a well-designed and well-facilitated expert elicitation that involves a broad spectrum of participation from experts with various expertise and backgrounds. And I'm thinking in particular of the expert elicitation that they did in Canada when they developed these measures, I think they had like a two, I'm not an expert on how these various programs work, but as I recall, at least in their initial stage, they had, they did do a fairly involved expert elicitation process and came up with, a normalized set of factors for exposure based on particular industrial uses and consumer uses that a chemical may be put to that could then get matched up to, like, I guess the Canadian equivalent of the SIC codes or the replacement for the SIC codes. So I think you could come up with a defensible and fairly useful screening tool for exposure, and it would be based on going out and collecting a lot of information. I think that'd be really hard to do early on. Or it could be based on a well-designed expert elicitation method. Thank you.
This is Julia. I just wanted to clarify, it was my opinion that we were veering away from expert judgment. I feel that expert judgment is going to be a crucial part of this at every step of the game. There's just no way you can get away from it because I thought I heard that, the statute calls for criteria. So sometimes it's hard to develop criteria by saying, how to factor in expert judgment into criteria is sometimes hard. But I am not saying that we shouldn't use it because I think we have to.
Just so that maybe I can just clarify that point a little bit. The statute is somewhat flexible on that point. I mean, it does identify three minimum criteria that we are to take into consideration, but it does say including but not limited to. So that certainly opens up the door to consider other things, including, expert judgment and other factors that aren't listed in there. The other thing I will point out here, and we had quite a bit of discussion on this with the product subcommittee the other day, is that in order to meet the regulatory standards that are in California's Administrative Procedures Act, our regulations need to be fairly specific in terms of what the criteria are going to be that we're going to use. It's not a black and white line, as our attorney Colleen, who joined us, can tell you, but the less specific, the more nebulous, the more we're open to challenge. So,
this is Ken, and I think I'll call on myself here as well, just to say, say a word about this. I also believe that at least some kind of exposure consideration should be made. I think my priority is always to look at hazard and the inherent hazards of a substance as the first defining question, and then to look at the question of exposure. And my recommendation here is that the department do whatever it can not to get tied up in complexities over exposure. The hazard data, the hazard information we have is often, we often have a lot of solid kinds of data, that is lists and things like that. With exposure, it's much more difficult to kind of pin it down. It is useful. One little framework that we use at the Lowell Center is to look at three kinds of variables in regards to thinking about what might be surrogates for hazard or exposure. One is, what is a substance used for? Is it used for enhancing a coating? Is it used conduction of thermal energy? Is it used for various things like that, which give you some idea of where it is going to be? The second thing is, how is it used in that? Is the use dispersive? Is the use as a liquid? Is the use as a solid? Is it does it deteriorate in the time that the product is on the shelf or in commercial use or whatever? And the third element is how much of it is there? What is the volume of it, either in a product category or in the economy, or what is its concentration in terms of how heavy it is in its use, in the way it is used? And sort of between those three sort of variables, we try to estimate something about the level of what would be a surrogate for exposure. I note that the EPA's DFE program particularly spends time looking at that first question, which is how is the chemical actually used? What is it used for and how is it used, being important in their consideration. I think expert judgment is very helpful in these kind of things, and if the expert judgment is well managed, that is, the questions that are asked are put forward clearly and information is recorded the way we do the work of the Toxics Use Reduction Program Science Panel, is to make sure that that judgment is well managed such that it is really responsive to each of a set of questions that are asked and that those responses are recorded. I think you get a certain level of quality and stability and expert judgment that makes it of value and can be of great service, so I would recommend that as well.
And this is Julia. Can I just add something to that?
Yes, sure.
I would also add, because I agree with that list, and some of those were things that I had mentioned before, concentration and so forth. I would also add frequency of use and where it's used, because some products, because that's where we're headed with this, is products, are used. You know, you buy it, you maybe use it twice a year or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you might use it in a way outside or in some place where there's lots of ventilation if it's an inhalation hazard. And there are other things that are frequently used, and they're used in small spaces and where there is a higher potential for exposure. And then finally, in terms of expert judgment and how to manage, you know, the use of expert judgment, I feel that there is going to be in this process decision making, and then the rationale for that decision is where people get to see how expert judgment is used. In other words, when you make a decision, whether that's in some written form or just listing form, there will be a rationale for how DTSC came up with the decision to either list something as a priority chemical or a priority product, and all of the expert judgment things that we're talking about here will be spelled out. And I think that, you know, a lot has to fall into that bin, because it's just impossible to write into a regulation all of the sorts of nuances that we're talking about here.
Thank you, Julia. That's good additions to my comment. Great. Well, if there's not much more on exposure itself, maybe this next question really sort of picks up some of these same themes, but just targets it more about questions about issues such as thresholds themselves. Should there be a threshold established for the factors that are used to either identify or prioritize chemicals? And in particular, how do we handle questions having to do with Julia's already mentioned something about frequent exposures, cumulative exposures, or cumulative issues, impacts, things like thinking about the synergies of chemicals themselves as they react in the environment or in biota. What kind of advice or comments can we offer to the department on these issues?
Could you clarify threshold? This is Julia. I would like to have a basic understanding of what everyone is thinking about when you use the word threshold. Because it's not, I mean, okay. No.
Just so that, if you look at some of the examples that were supplied in the attachments, I think DFE is one of them, for example, and there are others. And this, I think, largely you see thresholds applied to hazard factors as opposed to exposure. But, for example, and sometimes it's used within a ranking formula, which is the next part of the question. Mm-hmm. But so a chemical may make it on or off the list depending upon whether or not it is above or below specified thresholds for different hazard factors. Mm-hmm. Or it might be put into a high, medium, or low category for a specific factor based upon threshold cutoff. So that was what we were thinking when we asked this question.
Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily a numerical threshold. It could be like a descriptive or for a hazard. If it's persistent or if it's bioaccumulative and also toxic, then that would reach a certain threshold. Or is that sort of...
Well, that's... Well,
or would you want to add
that lesson? We're
okay.
Taking your
right.
Expert advice
right.
On.
Okay, got it. Okay. All right. That's very helpful.
So this is George.
Yes, please.
I'm not entirely clear, but either. So you know, one of the things that we talked about last time was, say, the globally harmonized system for classification and labeling, which has for a large number of hazard endpoints. It has categories. So if something is, say, acutely toxic below 5 milligrams per kilogram, it would be in a very high potency category. Is that what we're talking about in terms of thresholds?
That could certainly be an approach, yes.
Okay. So in that sense, I think that, you know, again, this is one of those situations where, like the exposure considerations we just talked about, you know, there probably will be a need to go through and decide what should be in the chemicals of concern. And, you know, so one of the things that I think we've had on the table has been to limit it based on a certain select few hazard criteria. And in particular, we've talked a lot about CMRs, and I still think that that's a very viable approach in my mind. But if we want to expand beyond that, I think that it's absolutely necessary to have those kinds of threshold values, because, you know, once we get beyond things that are carcinogens and mutagens and arguably reproductive toxicants, everything is going to be toxic at some level. And so just in order to prioritize, I think we would need to have these kinds of threshold values. And I think that the GHS is a reasonable place to start in terms of finding what those values would be.
This is Julia. I would like to be...
Yes, Julia, go ahead.
I would agree with that. I like the GHS method because there is, it's objective. I mean, you can look at how they can look at it and make a decision. So I think that that's helpful. I also think that the hazard traits that OEA developed are very helpful because it's, strong evidence. And, forgot the next category. Their criteria for what constitutes strong evidence for a carcinogen or various categories, and I think that that's extremely helpful. Suggestive evidence is the next category, which is not so strong, but that, to me, is sort of a watch list, especially if we're talking about developing or providing guidance for people who are trying to come up with alternatives. They may choose not to have something that has suggestive evidence because it may turn into strong evidence in the next several years. So I think that the health hazard part of that list and also the environmental hazard part where you talk about strong and weak evidence and then you actually list what's strong, what constitutes strong evidence, I think is extremely helpful. But that's sort of how people make decisions. It's certainly how I've made decisions about hazard potential. I think less helpful to me are categories like medium, high, low, when it's fairly subjective. And even the EPA IRIS documents, which use the database characterizations as, whether or not the quality of the database is high, medium, or low, I think, sometimes that if you don't have the basis for your saying that, and maybe they do for some of them, I haven't, don't remember, but that becomes a little subjective because another toxicologist or somebody could look at it and have a different opinion about it. So I tend to not like things that don't have transparent basis for how you characterize something, you know, the threshold factor, and prefer those that, like the GHS and like the hazard trait descriptions that I just talked about, where you can look at it and say, oh, yeah, that's why it's strong, because, you know, this is, you know, how they describe strong or not so strong. So there was another thought that I had about another criteria, but I can't, another way that you could look at it, but I can't think of it right now. It'll come back to me. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Julia.
Tim, I'd like to get on.
Tim? Yes, Tim, go ahead.
I'm also put me in the confused a bit category in terms of understanding how the threshold would work. And I guess my concern, and maybe I just missed something, and I mean that sincerely, so correct me if I'm off base here, but my concern is just figuring out how a threshold, understanding how a threshold, the implications of it. I want to know more about what the overall system for prioritization would be. So if what a threshold for a particular factor does is knock something out of further consideration, that makes me somewhat nervous. And I'm wondering whether a threshold would be necessary depending on what kind of prioritization method you had. So, for example, if you had a prioritization method that assigns a score or rank or some kind of qualitative measure for each factor and then generates kind of a cumulative ranking or score based on that, I'm wondering what job the threshold is doing. How does that make the process more efficient to have a threshold, right? So can you help me with that? Did you already explain that and I just didn't understand, or?
Well, we're asking for your advice and experience on the, because if you look at some of the examples that, you know, we sent out, I think DFD and I think the state of Washington and their approaches are somewhat different, but they do embody, they have ranking systems, and they embody in those ranking systems some thresholds. So that was what we were looking at as a possible example and wanting your feedback on, you know, your thoughts on that.
So Tim, maybe I can help. So let's give a real obvious example.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that one of the hazard characteristics is acute toxicity. And as you know, you can load a rat with as much as you want, and eventually you will see the characteristic of acute toxicity. So in GHS, if I can remember right, the threshold is 5 milligrams per kilogram body weight. So those things that may be more toxic, meaning lower than 3 milligrams per kilogram or 5 milligrams per kilogram body weight as an LD50, those would be considered possibly highly toxic and therefore of higher priority. And those that are, their LD50s are like 1,000 milligrams per kilogram body weight may not be as potent and therefore not of consideration at this point, because that's not what would be part of a reasonable exposure scenario.
So I guess thank you, that's very helpful. And I guess what I'm having trouble with is when I think about the system that you just described, that to me sounds like a system that's attempting to identify whether a particular material exhibits a trait or doesn't, as functionally defined in that way, right? As opposed to trying to prioritize a whole set of chemicals as against each other across multiple criteria that you're thinking about all at the same time. So to me it seems like, well, what job does the threshold do for you there? So for example, assume you created this ranking system that uses high, low, medium, and maybe even have something that says minimal or none. And then assign values to each of those, and then in some way those are aggregated for a final prioritization ranking or number or whatever. You don't really have to come up with a threshold point in that case, right, because the lower toxicity of that material will be expressed through the fact that it's put into one category or another. So having a particular threshold that just excludes that, to me, seems, I don't know that it actually does that much work for you, and it seems that it reduces your ability to compare the various materials at the margins.
Well, I guess the approach, again, as Odette said before, we're looking for your comments. But again, the threshold is, in essence, a regulatory convenience. And it attempts to be a tool to focus regulatory resources and attention onto those things that matter and are most important, and try to, again, put those things which don't appear to matter into the background. And yes, there will be probably imperfections in such systems. But again, we can only do the best we can.
So let me just then here, I'll give you, this has really been helpful for me, and I can kind of give you, kind of synthesize this babbling I've been doing into a reaction, which is, it seems to me that establishing things as thresholds, that's going to create more administrative issues in the sense of those will be contested thresholds. And in any event, you will still have to, for each of the chemicals, collect the information to determine whether it's above or below the threshold. And to me, it seems like if you're going to end up collecting that information anyhow, and if you're going to have a system that, you know, would take that information into account in any event, right, you know, some type of a ranking system that looks at the value for that particular criteria, perhaps applies a weighting to it, and then generate some aggregated assessment, whether that's qualitative or quantitative. To me, it seems like you are losing some information about a chemical. You're still going through the process of generating data to make that threshold determination, and you're adding on top of that kind of the angst and administrative and legal issues that occur when you try to establish particular thresholds for chemicals. So to me, I'm not sure that, depending on what your prioritization system ultimately looks like, it's not clear to me that creating a threshold really reduces the regulatory burden when you're talking about a prioritization system versus just a kind of a labeling system where you're trying to alert to people that it should be of concern or not on discrete traits.
Well, this is Jeff again. I think it's an attempt to focus regulatory resources and to avoid any kind of apparent absurdities in the system. So let me give you an example. If I inject you with enough water, I'm sure that we can have some acute toxicity. Here's a product that's widely marketed, used every day for sensitive subpopulations. It's on your body, you drink it, and so we're trying to avoid having to list things like water as a chemical of concern because it possesses a hazard trait that we know we can elicit real toxicological studies. So, again, that's an absurd example, but it is a process convenience and a regulatory convenience.
And Ms. Odette, and then I know Julia wants to jump in here, but I just want to remind you that, you know, the purpose of the listing isn't just to put people on notice. I mean, that is a purpose, but it's also to identify those critical chemicals that we are going to devote resources to move forward in the process in terms of identifying priority products and then requiring alternative assessments. So we need some sort of scheme, whether it's thresholds or something else, to define a cutoff. Just a reminder, and then Julia, I know, wants to jump in. I
Yes, Julia, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess different ways of looking at things. Tim, I think that the threshold system, at least as it is in my mind, and I go to the hazard traits where you're talking about strong evidence for carcinogenicity, and then that involves, is it 1A, is it a 1 classified in as a human carcinogen, or is there, you know, reasonably anticipated to be a carcinogen? I mean, those sorts of descriptors or categories for carcinogens, it's very helpful. I mean, you know, otherwise, you know, you're looking at many chemicals and then there's no way to sort out whether or not which ones are of higher priority versus another. So this is what, you know, most of us do all the time if you're, you know, evaluating hazards. So getting away from the acute toxicity examples that Jeff mentioned, for the chronic toxicants, and again, the hazard trait spells it out, I think I consider those like threshold descriptors for how you would prioritize. I like that much better than the ranking system where you take a bunch of data and then you assign weights to it, because to me, you know, I've looked at those systems and they're very, very subjective to me. And thank you for the handouts. I thought they were very, very helpful in thinking about just this issue, the ones that you provided. The NRC document, for instance, that reviewed a number of different programs and how they prioritized. It was for water, but still very helpful. And I tended not to like the ones that had numerical weights and, you know, did it that way because they gave an example of one TCE, a trichloroethylene, was completely left out of one of the group's prioritizations because it didn't have the right data in it. So I just, you know, feel that the threshold factors, especially, and I think the hazard traits for carcinogenicity and for various of the CMRs, or however we're classifying the health hazards, do include the GHS category 1 or, you know, those categories in it. So for me, it really narrows the universe. It really makes me focus on not a whole list of, like, you know, a lot of carcinogens or a lot of mutagens. And the GHS, for instance, not all mutagens are treated equally. Heritable mutagens are things that can be passed on to the next generation in terms of mutagens, get a much higher priority than an in vitro mutagen that contributes to the evidence for carcinogenicity, and I think that's appropriate. I think that really, and then they go further to tell you which, you know, what type of data will help you identify a heritable mutagen, like dominant lethal assays. Maybe it's because I'm, you know, I think as a toxicologist, but those kinds of things, knowing what data are out there, is very, very helpful, and as Jeff said, in narrowing the universe to be able to focus down on something even before you get to the product, which is, I think, what you have to do with everything that's listed. It's not only quality, but, you know, if you don't have some criteria about how to go a little bit deeper than just carcinogen listed, you know, listed carcinogen, with the Prop 65 list, you know, you would have to, there, all the carcinogens from the authoritative bodies are listed, but you go to IARC or NTP and see what category of carcinogen it is or something like that. I think it's extremely helpful. And I know there's just many ways for us to look at this, and we should look at it through all them. So I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just giving, you know, in my having to evaluate hazards, it's really helpful to have some sort of threshold that you can look at.
Ken, may I be, this is Art. May I be added to the queue, please?
Yes, Art, you're next.
This is Art Fong. When I was thinking about the threshold question, two things came to mind. I was, like Tim, somewhat confused about how the term threshold is being used in our discussion. You know, I thought of it two ways. One is threshold is kind of a bright line cutoff for including or not including a chemical into the what we were talking about, parking lot list of, you know, chemicals concern. So in that situation, I think, you know, a threshold, it's a practical necessity going along the lines of what Jeff and Odette were saying, how that, you know, for resource considerations to help us focus in on chemicals that are, in fact, of the greatest concern. And then I also thought about threshold in terms of it being a categorizing or prioritizing mechanism. So that's in line with what Julia is saying. So, you know, as I was thinking about this, about the necessity of threshold, just as a practical matter, I thought that was a necessity in terms of helping us decide, or DTSC decide, what chemicals to focus the resources on to narrow the universe of chemicals to those that are of the highest concern in terms of potential human health and environmental impact. And in terms of, you know, the second use term threshold for prioritization and, you know, putting chemicals into different categories, a number of the colleagues on the panel have mentioned about GHS, and I just want to emphasize the point that that is really a good basis for us to start, not only because of, you know, the clearly defined different categories, but because how GHS is being implemented in other regulations in other regions. And it's in terms of, you know, helping industry or helping stakeholders who would have to deal with compliance issues, harmonization and it's really important. And since, and again, GHS is the basis of many of the regulations on the horizon, and with OSHA coming up with, you know, GHS as the basis of HASCOM in August. So I think GHS is also a really good place to start. Thank you very much.
This is Ken.
I'd like to put on a few, Ken, please.
Yeah, let me just move in here for a moment, Tim. I just one point of why I think the last call I made it clear that I'm kind of one who proposes two lists, and I think that it's relevant in a case like this, because for me, the first list, the idea of having a list of chemicals of concern, is a place where you would not have thresholds, because you're really trying to indicate to the market kind of what the state thinks are chemicals of concern in general, and therefore provide the first basis for thinking about how you start the entire program, but not necessarily picking the priorities. And the second list, the priority chemicals of concern, is a place where thresholds begin to make more sense, because you're now thinking more about what the state can actually do and how to focus and target the state's resources. So for me, I don't find this confusing, because I think that the two lists provide a different opportunity for thinking about thresholds. Tim.
I am in the happy situation of being able to say I agree with everyone. Because I think maybe we're talking about different conceptions of what the threshold is and what it would be. And let me point out why I think that is. Maybe I'm really disagreeing with everyone. That's okay for us to disagree. But I was reading this question. I took it to mean, should there be a threshold established for each factor? I took that to mean a threshold, say, if you were looking at carcinogenity, a threshold for mutagenicity, a threshold for, you know, so on down the line. And that just didn't seem to make sense to me. I agree with both Ken's and Art's points, which I think are somewhat similar, which is at some point you look at the total picture for a particular chemical and you say, this is not of enough concern for us to continue worrying about it in the regulatory scheme. Doesn't mean people aren't interested in it and there aren't good reasons for people knowing about that chemical, but, you know, you look at a chemical and when you look at all the various hazard traits and criteria, you say overall, this just doesn't rise to the level of concern that we can deal with either from a resource basis or just from a, you know, public health basis. We're just not worried enough about it. And if that's what is meant by threshold, I don't have any problem with that concept. I think, of course, there's a lot of work to be done in figuring out where that should be and how it's figured out and so on and so forth. But I don't have any concern with that as being the threshold. But I didn't take that as being what this question. This question asks about establishing a threshold for each individual prioritization factor. And that, I guess I don't understand that, how that would help at all. And maybe that's where, maybe I'm just misunderstanding the question. Because, you know, Jeff's example, I mean, water, you're right, it makes the point. But even in these questions, it could be that you're going to have a chemical that is fairly low concern for a particular hazard trait, but it's going to be of moderate concern on others, and when you look at it all together, you know, it comes out somewhere in the middle. I don't see what having thresholds for those individual factors for, say, we got to pick a point at which we're not worried about cancer very much for this particular chemical. Why do that when you're looking at kind of a continuous sense of how worried you are about this chemical in light of all these other factors? That was my point, and I think maybe I was just reading threshold differently than everybody else. And it's also the word threshold, I think, is a loaded term generally. Maybe there's another word that could be used to describe this notion.
Okay, we've spent quite a bit of time on this threshold issue.
Can I?
If there's any, George, I guess you haven't spoken to it.
I did once, but I'll just, you know.
Okay.
So I will agree completely with Tim about the loaded nature of the word threshold, and it might be something that you know, as you proceed, that you want to find a different term for. But I certainly you know, have already spoken to the fact that I like the idea of having a classification system that includes some sort of consideration of potency, which the GHS does. It's going to help you out. The other reason why I like it and why I would want to have that kind of information associated with a chemical regardless of which list it's on is, you know, I happen to consider potency to be an inherent property of the chemical just as much as its qualitative hazard. And I think it is important in conveying why something gets on a list of concern, particularly when we move past the carcinogens and mutagens and start talking about things that are regulated because they have neurotoxicity or some sort of acute toxicity. It is important to convey you know, something about the potency of those things, and I think that this kind of classification system facilitates doing that.
Did I hear there was someone else who wanted to?
Yeah, Julia. Thank you for putting me in the queue. This is very brief. I think, you know, even though I, you know, like the GHS system, I think there's another part of, it's not our question, but one subcommittee is dealing with de minimis. And I just want to bring up that, you know, it's not compatible with the GHS in the area of carcinogens. You know, they have thresholds. I mean, they have a, you know, 0.1% for carcinogens, I think, in some part of their classification system. And also to point out that the GHS system, as it's the sort of details we're talking about, is really their equivalent of hazard communication because it's classification and labeling. And so acute hazards and corrosives, explosives, all of those categories take a, you know, a highly profile because you're talking about moving goods through commerce. And our purpose is different. So in the beginning, I was not a big fan of using GHS for this process because of that. But there are some things that, you know, you would want to think about differently maybe. And, you know, we've actually pulled those out, like de minimis, as one of the areas. So I just wanted to make sure that we were, you know, aware of that. Thanks.
Thank you, Julia. I'd sort of like to move us along a bit to keep us on a schedule here and just see if there's any comments on the second part of this question, that is basically six, whatever, which is asking in the prioritization, how important should issues of cumulative adverse impacts be in helping to set priorities. Can we maybe offer some comments on this question?
And just so that if you do think it's important, if you could provide advice on how we would go about evaluating that.
Anyone?
You were silent too long, so I perked up. I think both the individual chemical and I think both the chemical's individual threat of adverse impact is important for prioritization, because we just gave some examples of that. You know, all chemicals are not equal, even in a certain category. So I think looking at the potency, you know, I don't necessarily want to use the word potency, but looking at, you know, the strength of evidence or whatever of that chemical versus another one is important. I also think looking at it from a cumulative aspect is also important. And I'll give my favorite chemical is 1-bromopropane, which is listed under Prop 65 as a male and female reproductive toxicant, a developmental toxicant, and the cancer test has just come out positive. There's a positive NTP cancer bioassay for this chemical. So here you have a four. You know, you have a chemical that has all of these really serious adverse impacts, the potential to have very serious adverse impacts, plus it's a solvent, so it's emissive and you can be exposed, it's in spray cans, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I think I would not look at that, I would take that chemical and prioritize it higher if it's in a consumer product or whatever, if the consumers could be exposed to that, then I would a chemical that was only a carcinogen, you know, because this is, you know, it has all of those things. And if it's further, if it's used in a product where we had, you know, susceptible populations or vulnerable populations or sensitive subpopulations, I guess is the word, then, you know, it would get a high priority. So I think both cumulative, I don't think you can really separate them. And there are some chemicals that have the health hazard trait, and they're also, you know, are global warmers or ozone depleters and, you know, the environmental side of it. So I think you can. I think both are important. I'll just end there. And you said how would you...
Well, how would you evaluate cumulative, or some people use a slightly different term, aggregate, adverse impact?
Okay, so it could be more than one of the hazard traits. I gave an example of a chemical that had four of our hazard traits. So I think that's one way. You know, chemicals have multiple hazard traits of high priority.
That's a good point. That's a good thought. But actually, when we posed this question, we were thinking more in terms, and this is something we've gotten comments from a number of stakeholders on, is that certain chemicals contribute to cumulative impacts either because the chemical itself is in a number of frequently used products, and or the chemical and other chemicals that present the same adverse impacts are in a number of products. So,
right.
So this is George. Go
ahead,
George.
Can I just finish up, George?
I was just going to say. When I read this, when I read this question, I was thinking much more about cumulative risk assessment, so where multiple chemicals would combine to have an effect, and I'm not sure. It's almost as though in this particular kind of a system, you'd have to just through a lot of expert judgment determine whether there were families of chemicals that you would want to evaluate together. Like certain of the phthalates or something like that. And, you know, it would certainly be, I think, reasonable to do that if we knew that that chemicals were related and acting by a common mode of action. I think that that's going to require an additional level of expertise in the evaluation process to do that. I would not put that outside of scope, but, it's just be warned that it will, require additional evaluation of weight of evidence that, that things are acting by a common mode of action. I think there will also be cases where you will be dealing with mixtures that are mixtures of compounds that, that really aren't separable to their individual components, and you know that might be something else to think about as to how to get those into some sort of a prioritization scheme. So gasoline's a combination of chemicals, but I don't think we ever consider it as individual chemicals, and so that's something to consider as you weigh in. One thing that I disagree with Julia on, just for the record, is I'm not sure that I would rank something as a higher priority because it causes multiple kinds of effects. I'd be much more concerned, even if something caused one effect, if it were highly potent and had high potential for exposure.
Julia, do you want to go on?
This is Julia. Did you call on me? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, just to comment on George's last disagreement with me. Yeah, no, I would agree that I mentioned that chemical just because I was describing a chemical that had many different endpoints. Of course, potency, where it's used. I think I pointed out that if it's used in a product, if it's not used in a consumer product, then it wouldn't be prioritized, number one. But so I would agree with that statement. I also think that if we had a way of determining chemicals that showed up in multiple consumer products, I think Odette mentioned something like that. I think that that would be a way to help prioritize. And also there are products and consumer products that have what I call cocktails of chemicals that, either have the same endpoint that we're concerned about, like there may be more than one chemical that's toxic to the endocrine system, or there may be more than one carcinogen in a particular chemical. I've seen that a number of times. So some products, a chemical showing up in multiple consumer products to me would be an accumulative impact because that chemical is going to, have hits on when used in various types of things. And also products that have chemical combinations that are of concern, either the same health endpoint or two separate serious health endpoints, I think would be important.
Well, we have been going for just an hour and a half at this point. Would people like a break at this point, or do you want to continue?
I think we'd like a break, Ken.
Okay. In that case, why don't we take a short break, like about 5 or 6 minutes, because we have a short time. So
let's take it open.
Be in recess for about 5 or 6 minutes then.
And don't hang up.
Don't hang up.